when you're on the uphills, as in one of these long races, go slow, kind of reflect, you know, re-energize where possible, because then on the downhill, accelerate, as in, you know, when things are going well, do more of that.
This podcast is brought to you by Pragmatic Solutions, the leading iGaming PAM platform with a modular approach, including many benefits like a fast, secure, and scalable API-based platform integrated with all major third-party products and services. Make sure you head over to Pragmatic Solutions and join our smart thinking.
This podcast is brought to you by Pragmatic Play, a leading game developer providing player favorites to the most successful brands across the industry. With an award-winning multi-product portfolio of slots, live casino, bingo, virtual sports, and more, Pragmatic Play is powering up new possibilities of play through one single API. Visit pragmaticplay.com and discover your favorite every time.
So, okay, let's jump into it. I mean, first and foremost, knock, knock.
Who's there?
Back.
Back who?
Welcome back to the podcast, James.
Amazing. Yeah. Glad to be back. Thank you.
Yeah. We gotta go full circle in the knock knock jokes. This is our tradition, my friend.
I forgot it. It's something. It's been too long.
Yes, exactly. And you know, when we did our first podcast, James, we've been kind of on a similar journey, you and me. We started our little ventures together in a fairly similar time frame, and obviously we've seen the companies grow from there. And you had some pretty fantastic news recently with the deal together with Light & Wonder taking a stake in your company and really kind of hyper-charging flows. But before we go into that, it'd be really interesting to kind of hear, like, from your words, just this story from when you founded the company, when you started the company together with Robin and Happy Hour till today. Like, how has this journey been for you so far?
Bloody hard work.
Right?
I think as anyone knows that's kind of been a part of or started a company, it's a hard road to take.
I've become a coffee drinker since I started.
Have you?
Actually, yeah.
I'm probably
never
an addict.
Used to drink coffee.
You've become a coffee addict, not just a drinker. Support you on the late nights and early starts.
That's it.
But all that said, it's been an amazing journey as well. You meet so many kind of hardworking people, and we have a ton of them with us at Flows that's sort of taken us to where we are today. And from day one as well, having the support, you know, you touched on it with Happy Hour and with Robin, that's been vitally important. I think it sits differently to, I believe, a lot of some more traditional VCs or investors that perhaps haven't themselves been on the journey or don't have as clear an understanding of product and B2B. And for me and us as Flows, having Robin as that sort of first investor in Happy Hour as our kind of seed investor from day one, we've had a lot of support sort of beyond the financial part of that. And, you know, he can advise and offer a lot of sympathy, having done it himself, well, now numerous times. So that was really kind of key for us at the start. And then putting together a select few of really, really good kind of phase one Flows people. There weren't many of us, there still aren't many of us, but the few that were kind of that are a part of it have worked so hard to kind of drive a vision that we knew would add so much value to this space, hopefully to other industries in time. And so kind of with them, there's been tireless sort of efforts to get us to where we are. It's just, it's mad. There's so many parts to the journey. There's so many highs, but then they're always coupled with some kind of low.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure you've seen it as well. You know, like, I feel it's not like a frustration, but it's a reality that you have a big win, but you know that there's something coming over that kind of hill on the other side that's not the big win. And there's some kind of kickback. It's like you take two steps forwards and you're excited, and then there's a step back, or even two steps or three steps back.
Yeah, exactly.
And that seems to be like a weekly, a monthly kind of, it's a cyclical thing, I think, with a startup.
Yeah, for sure.
And you have to toughen up quickly and kind of learn to get over them, but learn to sort of try and understand why they happened. I think every time there's the setback or the two steps back or negative, if you want to call it that, there's a huge learning opportunity. And again, I think we as Flows, as a small team over the last couple of years, have been really good at learning and adapting kind of on every setback or however you want to kind of position that,
yeah.
as well as to maximize on the steps forward.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like understand why something's going really well and do more of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a simple.
Can you introduce for the few people that maybe don't know Flows and what you do, what is the company producing exactly?
Flows is producing or has produced an awesome bit of software that allows people to build and innovate without needing to code. So the whole idea kind of way back when was that we wanted to bring something agnostic to the market, whether it's for operators, platforms, you know, suppliers, affiliates, that would take away, I guess, kind of the onus and the pain point on their in-house tech team and developers to always be the ones that have to build and deliver. So we know like roadmaps take a long time. You want to do something new, digitally speaking, whether it's a new product you want to release or you want to adapt, if it's a PAM, your PAM, change to regulatory requirements, whatever it might be, that is a hard lift. You know, it takes people with coding skills, your developers, a reasonable amount of time to sort of work through that. And we wanted to find a better solution or create something that'd be a better solution for people to, in its first instance as Flows, to alleviate that. So we built Flows to kind of ingest data and put it in a format that allows most people to be able to build products without needing to be a developer. You know, it's like you being able to build a car without being an engineer, because you have a basic set of instructions, like a really easy kind of Lego box of things to use in a really nice interface. And that's what we wanted to do, and found a way to do it, I think, in a sense that's not been done before. Right. And not to this level. Like there's out there in the market, and we kind of sit across things like automation platforms, no code, innovation, rules engines.
Maybe ChatGPT is part of this, right?
ChatGPT like
is that a competitor to you?
No, it's a compliment. In a sense that the day dot of ChatGPT launch, or kind of not just called ChatGPT, like language models, right? AI right. language models. Mm-hmm. Sort of the ability to ingest a huge ton of data and then sort of make sense and act on that has been a really complementary, innovation out there for Flows. So we were doing something that was accelerating someone's, as said, kind of development or product delivery or roadmap, whatever it is they were using us for. We were enabling them to do it, well, just to do it in some instances, but also to do it far faster than perhaps they could have done. This has now enabled us to do it even faster because, you know, within our interface, we've kind of coordinated with some language models that allow you to just ask Flows. I mean, we did it on a demonstration at, in Valletta at Next
right.
Last year, where we literally spoke into the Flow system and asked it to build us, I think that instance was a jackpot. And within 2 minutes, we had a jackpot built.
Right.
So in that sense, it's been amazing for us. And we continue to kind of work with it, sort of alongside or within our technology.
Yeah, interesting. So to take a step back, James, we talked about the many ups and downs that comes with the gig of starting a company and building something great. A couple of years ago, you went through a funding round and as most of us know that have gone through this kind of round, they can be really gritty and it takes a lot of energy from you, energy that you want to spend in building your company that has to go into instead kind of like chasing money and getting funding into the company. And you were really close to secure that funding with a really high profile fund. But then overnight, that fund closed just before the contract was going to be signed. Can you talk a little bit, like, that must have been one of the, like, the deep lows for you, I would imagine. So, like what type of stress does that cause when you've done all that work, all that due diligence, you've spoken to all those investors, you feel like you have finally got to a point where you secure the funding, and then overnight, boom, the rug is pulled away from underneath of you and you have to start over again. How was that?
I mean, okay, it was tough, yeah, to put it in the most simple terms. I think having had time to sort of digest, it was a great opportunity to learn. As a first-time founder, you know, it was an experience I hadn't been through to such a rigorous level in terms of going out and looking for funding or for kind of additional investors to join Happy Hour on this journey with us. And, you know, regardless of the outcome of that initial piece, I, you know, learned a huge amount, which is, I think, then, like, it kind of paid dividends later down the line with, you know, the news we announced recently. And I don't believe that, having had the experience I'd had before, perhaps this one would have been as smooth as it was. So I've kind of just taken the learning part from it and moved forward with that. It's worth saying as well that we, again, you know, and to any founder, be very, do your due diligence on who you're sort of supporting, kind of seed funding is, etc., because they're the ones that support you in the down times, you know, obviously, as well as being there when things are going really well. And there was never sort of that concern that, you know, without it we would be in a bad place, because Happy Hour from day dot said, look, you know, we really believe in this, we see the proposition for gaming, for out of gaming as well, like, we are fully behind you and committed to supporting you in kind of the journey that we know will be a success. And having that, like, just helped us kind of get over and move forward. We're also, and it's even with, you know, the round now, we were, you know, we had got revenues reasonably quickly. We gained clients quite early, even launching the first sort of edition of Flows, which is kind of a long way since then. But it meant that we were never really in a position where, you know, money's going to run out. What we were going, or kind of I was pushing on the raise for, and the most recent one is because we've just wanted to accelerate. Like, we've seen such amazing traction from clients. We have a huge kind of roster of leads that are kind of converting and coming in. And we also see a ton of opportunity to build out certain products to complement the Flows engine. And all of that actually requires a kind of big step up in the sort of Flows team. And that's kind of the big driver for the investment. Yeah. So that's my long answer to what could have been a short one.
fair enough. And obviously, you know, this kind of long road led to this big announcement that came during ICE a couple of weeks ago, where you announced this major partnership with Light & Wonder, one of the biggest gambling companies in the world, taking a stake in the company and looking to kind of hyper accelerate the company growth now. Can you talk about how that all came together? How did you first start communicating with Light & Wonder? Where did they see opportunity? And what will this mean for the company going forward?
Yeah, so a long story. I mean, quite early on in the Flows life, I think going back to ICE, when ICE was in April, you know, that, like, post-COVID,
right,
ICE that was in a weird time of year. We had been looked into by one of the team at L&W that were running the PAM. And they were really interested in Flows then, could see the potential, could see, actually, you know, this could help us kind of move forward with some of the work we want to do on the PAM, some of the work perhaps some of the clients are looking at. So we really kind of had a relationship quite early on. And, you know, we were sort of, I guess, for lack of better words, flirting for a while there. Over the next sort of 6 months, they were doing some changes, kind of we were continually updating it and working on our side. And then one point early last year, I think, getting my dates right, one of the team was like, hey, look, we want to start developing some new features on the game side. So put kind of pambered aside, but on the content piece, would you kind of come in and talk through perhaps what you could do there? And that's when we came in and said, look, we've actually started building out some flows that support kind of content bits. There's some gamification flows people were building or using our tools to kind of build and enhance, like chatbots, you know, missions, hot seats, these sort of things. And that's where it was like, ah, okay, you know, this we could really, we can really see some benefit and value in, you know, save us trying to build something out. What you've got's like very cool. And we built from there. And like what's, you know, I can only speak really for the LNW digital team that we sort of work with, but they're so forward thinking, you know, and the team obviously led by Dylan, you know, Daniel and others there really want to embrace kind of these modern technologies. And like, we are a very kind of modern technology. And they're sort of very open and kind of actually willing to work with external as well as sort of the in-house tech to take them, kind of drive them forwards and support kind of their roadmap of innovation as well. And that's where we kind of really started getting into it and going, look, you know, this could be a really nice sort of relationship here, you know. And then other conversations happen where it's sort of, how are you guys doing? Like, we got on very well. Hey, you know, we can maybe help you kind of accelerate in a sense of the stuff that you want to do. And then started looking at the opportunity down the investment piece. And yeah, the rest is the rest history, as they say. But like, look, it was, you know, it was a really nice matchup. I think put the investment aside, the money aside. It's actually the people that kind of we were meeting, kind of as I name checked earlier. But you know, when you sit with Dylan, when you sit with Daniel and others, you know, some of their tech leads as well. Like, these are people that get it. And then you go, okay, if I can have investors, as we've become kind of accustomed to with Happy Hour and Robin and his team, like if new investors also come in, but also get the tech, get like this product and really appreciate and understand it, it's like value add and where it could go, yep. Not just where it kind of is today, then that would be hugely beneficial to us. And that's where sort of I kind of started driving down that path, having been through many kind of conversations, etc., with you know, other avenues for investment that would have helped us accelerate. This suddenly became a very kind of clear piece to follow.
Yeah, I feel that it's a good point you make. You know, when you find this like synergistic potential shareholders to come on board with your on your journey, that's when you start a company. You know, there is a sense perhaps of urgency for a lot of founders at the start where, you know, just getting the money in the first place is a huge part of the journey, right? Like, just to get over the line of that first seed round, for example, there's so much uncertainty that it's that gets to the point of like securing that round, that a lot of founders will just take the money from wherever they can.
Exactly.
And the thing through this journey is like, there is so many points towards where you want to get to that will test you along the way. So example, if you would bring on board the wrong investor that doesn't fit on board with the rest of your cap table, or an investor that is a bit more predatory in their terms, you know, I think especially a lot of our more aggressive kind of American style investors, to be honest, like, they will come in with very aggressive terms in order to come aboard and to give you that money and so on. And they can take a lot of power from you in order to come aboard with you. And there are so many steps along the way where things can go extremely well until you make one mistake, kind of thing. And that sets the whole company back in a lot of ways. So, I mean, it must have been important when you went through these founder rounds as well, and building the company, just making sure that, you know, whoever you bring on board, you need to think about the next step after that, or the two steps after that, or four steps after that. Like, how will this chess move change the board for the future, essentially?
Yeah, totally. And as I said, I think kind of, again, you know, we found that right match with LNW. And people forget, like, hey, it's an easy thing to say kind of in hindsight, and perhaps at times, you know, you have to be in a pretty good position to be able to say it, but it's as much kind of them coming to you as well, sort of highlighting their value add, as well as obviously, yeah, you know, you're there looking for investment. So somewhat the upper hand is always with the money people. But, yeah, you know, when I think you kind of back your product that it is good enough and you have perhaps some opportunity with who can come in, it's actually like, okay, you know, but what value can you commit to back to us out, yeah, again, outside of the money, which is obviously a huge bit of the value. But like to hear from them, you know, we see where we can help drive it here and here, and we can, you know, utilize it with this. We can, again, taking on your investors, N&W, for instance, have, like, they work with everyone, right? So, you know, even on that kind of introduction side, or, you know, supporting us there, there's huge value in that. So,
yeah, because I feel like, you know, when you bring investors on board to your business, if you have, like, when you employ people to your business, you know, if you employ one wrong person, that person can really screw things up internally, yeah, and it can really set the company back. But then at least you have the option to fire that person and kind of reset and take a step back. But the thing with investors is, like, when you get an investor on board, you're committed, right? Like there isn't that step back from that point. And it's like, you know, it's a very intimate thing to bring investors on board to your company, because you're kind of like, you know, it becomes a little, almost like a little family, right? It's like, yeah, the family is what the family is. And like, and in your personal family, you will have really difficult people, but they are your family.
But right? Also, so, like, there's ultimate transparency. You can't, yeah, hide something from investors. No. You know what I mean? So like, yes, as you say, you've got to be really comfortable in being able to sit down when times are bad, as we're, yes, saying, as much as they can be good, and saying, this has happened, or this is going to, yeah, happen, or whatever. But you've got to be able to say that and talk through it with them. Right. And I think it's not an easy thing to do. You wouldn't even half the time say it to a friend, or, yeah, you would want to admit certain things. But again, like, it's your board, it's your investors, it's full transparency. So you've got to really find that comfortable,
yeah,
sort of mix.
Exactly. And part of this for, I think, especially a lot of private investors, is like a lot of investors, they want to be part of like a nice, like, mix and an exciting company, and it's kind of like fun to be a part of this journey, and it's fun to contribute with whatever the founder is asking for, or to be part of the conversations and trying to figure things out together and stuff like that. And again, like, it's so easy to lose that if you would just kind of take any money into the company, and you get investors in that are much more predatory, let's say, or they have a very different vision than what you have. And that's also like part of this, is like maintaining that good relationships between the owners in the company and between the cap table, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be pretty diligent in your shareholder agreements and your articles when you're creating,
yeah,
those.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
they set the kind of the framework.
Yeah, yeah.
In that respect, but like, it's like any contract, right? It's kind of a framework for when things don't go well. So you hope to not have to sort of refer to them.
Yeah.
But again, you know, if there's any sort of piece you'd say to other sort of startups or anyone looking for money, it's just do your piece of diligence while you're doing that,
yep,
because that is your, like, safety net, so to speak. And if you're not comfortable with something, like, speak up. Don't just say yes because it's going to get a deal, or you're worried it might affect not getting the investment,
yeah,
because ultimately you're kind of beholden to that, yeah, at the end, sure, of the day. Hopefully you never have to see it again, but like, not everything's always rosy, and occasionally you might.
Yeah,
I'd definitely say, you know, like, we've never had to, and I hope we never have to, but we were still very careful going through all that kind of process. But I think it can be not easily, but I can see how you could get quite incited with investment being there and being offered to just sign anything off to get it, to get,
exactly,
the deal done.
Exactly. It's like, that's the danger. Yeah.
Day one might be good when you get that cash,
yeah,
in the,
exactly,
bank, but
yeah, exactly.
You know,
because you also have to, I think you have to understand, each investor will have their own kind of perspective and background on things. If you get an investment from a VC fund, that fund will have a particular time commitment in the fund to pay their LPs back, for example. So say that there is a fund that is supposed to mature in like 5 years, for example. So that fund expects you to grow as much as you can in 5 years so that they can make an exit.
Yeah.
Right. And the other fund might have a 10-year window or 15 years or whatever it may be. And so like understanding that perspective, I think is really important to be aligned, like with what is your strategy and what is the strategy from the investor, because that might not be aligned. Even though you believe in the company itself, they might want you to take much more risk than what you are comfortable with, for example. And
yeah, definitely, you have to set that expectation day one, right?
Yeah.
Like, and again, when you're doing whatever it is, forecast, etc., that's all part of the due diligence. Like, you know, just again, be cautious with how you approach it. And as you say, like, remember, you could be beholden to someone else's time frames that aren't in line with yours and kind of your company path or vision, and like you might pivot, you might change, and that could really sort of take the arse out of whatever it is you had agreed to commit to.
In your experience, James, you've sat down with many investors through your fundraiser and had these conversations. Like, what would be your advice to founders who are raising capital in general? Like, what have you learned from all the conversations that you've had? How have you found success in these conversations? How different are they? Like, how knowledgeable are investors about your product? Is there like is there a lot of red threads, or is do you come into every meeting different?
A bit. I think if you can do some like background or due diligence on the firm, on the people you're meeting, to understand like kind of what their, I guess, perspective or their sort of knowledge base is, in a sense that you might meet someone, and we had with a couple in the past, they were super product knowledgeable. So you know that you can kind of get quite heavy on that side when you're pitching like what you have.
Right.
There's some that, you know, are more spreadsheet focused, and therefore you've got to fucking learn your forecasts and your numbers down to a T.
Inside out.
And like, if you are able to practice, one thing I could have done, but certainly in the first couple of rounds of meeting VCs like a few years back, is remembering that you're often a single person in a room of like 3, 4, right, maybe even more, right? And you get no time to think, whereas they do. So like, you have one person from, you know, XVC, they ask you a question, you're like, okay, you know, here's my projected multiples, or like da-da. They pause to consume it, but then the next person's got their question and you've had no pause, and they hit you with a question, you're like, okay, on to you, and they pause to consume it, but then the next one's asking you, like, you get no pause. And I remember in the first couple, like, I found it was overwhelming a bit, and there's not always much consideration for you in that, because, like, you know, they just want to rattle through this. They want to see, at times, okay, you know, where's...
They want to test you a bit.
Exactly. Like, where's a few of the weak
spots?
More
than anything, yeah.
But again, like, you know, I get it from their point of view too, right? They're looking to put money into something.
Yeah.
Like, they need to know everything about you, because they are being entrusted by others to sort of manage money.
Yeah.
So they can't just be like, hey, you seem a really nice person, here's some money. Mm. Like, you know, if they know your weaknesses or the areas you're not so strong on, whatever you want to call it, kind of, they can make a better sort of judged decision on whether to invest in you, and like knowing the type of sort of person you are and perhaps business then you've got. So I do understand it, but it doesn't mean it makes it kind of any easier in those first few meetings. So perhaps the lesson that would be to go in with someone else from your company, mm-hmm. if you can. Sort of, I've kind of often done them solo, which is fine. And, you know, as I said, you kind of learn a lot, you toughen, you know what to go in next time to expect, and you prep yourself better.
Yeah.
I'm sure the first time I met a VC, kind of, while I was wet behind the ear, they probably thought, this person's not done enough kind of research on X, Y, and Z. And perhaps the last time I met one, I was more refined.
Yeah, it's like,
but I practice. Think like if you went in with someone else from the company, it could probably just help you sort of
I think I've been to that point too. Like if you are going into kind of your first pitch meetings and stuff, it could be good to just do some like role playing with people close to you that can ask you difficult questions just to see how well prepared you actually are, right? Because you don't know until you get those questions.
Oh, perhaps then, like
because there's no room for like, oh, let me look that up. Like there isn't like any room for that, right?
Well, perhaps one of the good, you know, media companies in our space could set up a pitch practice.
That's for something, yeah.
You know, sponsored by someone, and you can help startup or founders with that pitch practice.
That would be a good idea, actually. Yeah,
drawing knowledge because
could you do that at the conference? Could be a good idea, actually.
Yeah, look, at the end pitch of the day, practice. You know, you live and die by that pitch, right?
It's a good idea, actually.
You come in with the best freaking idea in the world, but. Yeah. If someone says, what's your business doing? You're like, well, like you don't get any money. I mean, it could be the next GPT or something else, but you've got to be able to articulate it and go through that phase that we've all been through that raised money, say.
Yeah. I asked Tim Heath, the founder of YOLO Investments, you know, €650 million euro fund. You know, like in general, you know, how many investments do you make per 100 pitches? You know, and it's like, one maybe, and you can imagine essentially you got to be 1 of 100. And as you just point out, you can have the most incredible idea, you know exactly how to execute it, you have all the right knowledge and the right people behind you, but if you're not able to express that comfortably to the investor within a very short amount of time and predict that security or that knowledge, you're not gonna stand out as those 1 of 100 because the investor is not gonna spend more than a couple of minutes on you, if even that. If you get to the point of even having that meeting.
Yeah, exactly. It's just not worth their time.
Exactly.
You know? And as you say, they've got 99 others to.
Yeah. People make
through.
Like the investors make mistakes all the time. Like you know, there's like famous examples of Uber being started and many top investors passing on that opportunity because they didn't believe in the concept of ride hailing. And I mean, there's countless of
these. But for you know, that first pitch was rubbish.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, so they didn't pitch it in the right way. I mean, look, they've gone on and done okay since. But it's a great point that it's almost less, you know, an investor's failing to have not invested as much as kind of the company, the founders themselves probably didn't.
Exactly.
But they learn, you know. Obviously, they learn because, you know, the rest is history with Uber and the likes of it. But it's like you hear people that passed up on the Beatles or whatever, and they might have gone in and just been hungover and played a crap song for once, you know. And then the next time they went in, they were really good, and you know, whoever it is picked them up. So
exactly. They started by playing Yellow Submarine. No one else is. Then they went on with Hey Jude, and everyone is like,
boom,
this is the best.
You're in. Done.
Bingo, bango. So James, you know, as you are now kind of settled into this somewhat new strategy now that comes with working with someone like Light and Wonder, who is kind of coming on board on this journey with you and turbocharging the organization. What do you see as kind of the long-term goal with the business moving forward? Where do you go from here, do you think? Like,
I mean, I said, like, we went through this round to accelerate. So it's not so much, I guess, a strategy change, more that we've got a ton of fuel to really sort of drive what we wanted to do, and kind of, which is work with as many people as we can in this space and then into other markets as well. In its initial sort of piece following the investment, we're staffing up a little bit.
How many people are you? Oh.
So we are now 15, I think, as I'd say, 15, 16.
Yeah.
I mean, we've run a pretty lean ship up to now. Again, you know, perhaps another sort of learning or piece to other founders. We've like never wanted to extend ourselves too much because I think, and I hear stories of those that get to like big numbers of employees quite quickly, without necessarily having the revenue or clients or whatever to sort of reflect that. And I've never wanted to be in that position that we're so overextended that without, you know, big funding rounds, we're potentially in trouble. So as said kind of at the start, we've had a few, but like really good people executing exceptionally well from day one. And now we're able to bring in a few more, but again, we've been very selective in the latest sort of hiring phase where we've brought some more in, making sure we're just getting some like really top talent that understand kind of the product, the vision, and can help drive that. But we will kind of continue to sort of be very sensible, I think, in this phase. You're not going to see, you know, Flows next month announce our 50th employee and like five new offices or something ridiculous like that. We really sort of put the finances where we can see the kind of value back. So that's kind of this initial piece. But as said, like the bases are loaded in terms of opportunities. Like, so we have a great pipeline of clients coming in. I think this year we've already signed up three, with more announcements, hopefully in the next couple of weeks. But some specific products. So, you know, the base of Flows is the Flows engine, the piece that we kind of give to enable everyone to innovate and build with, the sort of no code automation part. But we too sort of have seen, I guess, gaps where we can build product on top of the engine to give to clients, clients we have, and sort of offer to market to bring in new clients that I think be a big kind of value add. So we're looking at that, and we're going to announce our first kind of couple of sort of product add-ons, so to speak, in the not so sort of distant future. And at some point we're going to start looking at markets to kind of complement the one we're already in. I said this tool was never designed just to be a tool in gaming. You know, we came as founders and kind of as our first sort of phase of team from gaming. So we appreciated kind of the use cases and knew the value add. But I think we've always been cognitive of the fact that this could be a really, and will be a very powerful tool in other markets as well.
Right, so it's not only this tool. You are kind of starting off by niching yourself to the online gambling industry. This is where you have your network and you know the industry inside out. But the long-term play is here is to extend yourself outside of
gambling. Like, and we've sort of spoken to and seen experts outside of gaming, gaming gambling, and they kind of see the value in it as well. Like, this could be really cool. As I said, out in the wider market, you've got like automation tools, for example, like a Zapier. Okay, that looks beautiful, but is, I think, reasonably limited in some of its kind of deeper functionality. And the point with Flows is that it looks good and it's easy to use from a kind of UX point of view, but it can actually do some really sort of deep and intricate stuff, can deliver some really heavy, kind of tech lifts. And I've not seen anyone kind of hit that middle ground of something that looks really nice, like a Zapier, for example, and something that can offer you like a really complex no-code sort of situation. Like, there's companies like a MuleSoft that are no-code, but like you'd have to be a developer to use it. It's so freaking complex. It does cool stuff, but it's very complex. And like our drive, a vision is always sort of hit the middle ground, you know. An easy user face so you can empower loads of people to innovate, but the innovation to some extent is endless. We don't want it to be limited by X or Y. It's why, for example, like volume is a big thing with Flows that I don't see many others having delivered outside of in the wider tech space. They all struggle with big volume, and because when we sort of built Flows, the blueprint was always that you've got to be able to handle casino spin, like game spin event, in terms of kind of data coming in and that kind of volume, which is probably some of like the highest like data volumes you get in the world, right? Like, think of, you know, the biggest casino in the world and how many game spins are happening at any second. Like, the numbers are huge. And I don't know if there's many markets that, if you think of, like, let's say a click or any kind of event online, like you click to buy something, you click to register for a ticket, even to go to Glastonbury, that has that level of volume.
Right.
So day one, and that's a really hard thing to handle from any company that ingests data and, you know, does whatever it does in real time. We knew we had to handle that. And so I think that in itself will give us a unique position out of gambling as well.
Yeah, right.
Which is cool.
Do you see yourself, like, who are your competitors today? You mentioned a couple of companies that are not necessarily gambling focused. Do you have any competitors within the industry, would you say?
not in a way, not in the wider piece of what we do. I think, and it's all dependent on the use case, on how someone or an organization uses us. Okay, because like a good example is L&W's first use case is kind of we announced, I think, back in October. They're using us or using our technology to support them in building out marketing chatbots. Other companies do chatbots. So you could say in that specific use case, our competition is X, Y, and Z that right. can offer a chatbot. But that's just like what we would call a flow. And, you know, that's one product you build within our engine. So you could come in and create 30 mini companies right. in a manner of speaking. Yeah. And that would just be like a basic package with flows. We don't view that as a company, and therefore there's no specific competition that has that, I guess, agnostic, that approach.
Yeah, exactly. Is it scalable? Do you think the product, like when you sign new clients, how much effort goes into from your side in order to upskill a new client, for example, or can they learn the tool themselves?
Yes. So the aim is that, you know, you become autonomous in using it. Day one, we have full kind of training, as I think like any SaaS product, right?
Yeah. Salesforce, for example, or whatever. It's like there is a learning curve essentially.
Out of the box. Take this up. Like, you know, it's all, you know, as you say, any tool, as simple or as complex, you always need some form of learning. And we have that. We have a full sort of learning suite, and we have an amazing team of success managers that sort of sit side by side with whoever's just taken the product, help them build out those first use cases. We also have what we call templates, which are sort of pre-built flows. Now, they're not enabled unless you want them to be, but it's more a playground that you can kind of go in and find 50 plus templates, mini products that you can go, oh, that's really cool. Like, how does it work? I can play with it a bit. Maybe you just think there's great value from day one. I'm going to enable it. Like, let's go run. And over time, we find that teams just start using it themselves and are less reliant on us. But I think what's key is that we are always there as well. Like, you try and build out this product and you're stuck somewhere, you know, you can just ping one of the team and it's like, hey, can you help me a bit? And they can jump in and sort that for you. Yeah. So,
is that an element, like to say, you know, in the future when you start scaling the business and you want to move outside of gaming, for example, at some point you may be, if you are successful, you may be facing the fact of rather than onboarding 3 customers, you maybe are looking to onboard 1,000 customers, let's say. Does that only work with scaling your in-house staff, or is there an element there of like trying to automate that process to some extent?
Oh yeah, definitely.
In the long run, you know?
Always. Like the long term has always been for it to be within reason completely autonomous.
Create a flow. Create a flow to automate.
Yeah, but again, the onboarding process. This is where we've got the language models.
Use your own tool, James, to create a flow to automate the process.
But this is where we've got the language models, is that someone can take it and just ask it to build it, and then it's built. We've always had a vision one day to offer a freemium model as well, like for an everyday use, right? So you go on, connect a couple of your tools that are on your iPhone or something, say like Slack or Messenger, and a weather tool, and you can just say like, hey Flo, I've got a meeting tomorrow at 10, like can you just let me know if it's raining and remind me to bring an umbrella? And it sort of builds this like this flow for you, and one day in that sense, then yeah, like people would just be running off building their own things. I think one day it'd be quite cool to have like this gig economy built as well, that I, as a, I know, a product person, even a university student, goes into the marketplace, creates a really cool complex flow and puts it in that people can then kind of take and use, you know, like a bit of a Spotify model that singers can you know, monetize by the amount of downloads they get or views. We could have a similar one at some point with flows. I create something that's like hyper value for Meditech because like it triggers off this, it does this, it does that. And the more that are downloading or using my kind of creation, sort of the more value I get back from it.
Right. Just so. To take a step back here, James, you obviously were able to secure this capital now from Light and Wonder, and you know, as you secure that capital, there's always this like phenomena of first you feel like you're sorted, you know, you have like unlimited funds all of a sudden, but this capital tends to be spent much faster than what you think. And I saw a survey the other day by Jesse Learmouth of betting startups, and one of the questions there to the startup founders was, how have you funded your company? And option A is by raising capital, and option 2 is by bootstrapping. And I thought it was a bit funny that those were the two options, because to me it was like, well, if you raise capital, you probably still want to be bootstrapped.
Yeah.
Right. And exactly. And I get the feeling sometimes a lot of founders, they will raise that capital and they'll spend it on kind of unnecessary things and so on. Like how do you
look, we touched on it earlier, right? Is that okay, firstly we're at a position that we were there or thereabouts on break even, or at least had a path very soon to be break even with clients coming in and the revenues we were already doing and having a very controlled sort of outgoing in terms of spend. So this was to come in and support us accelerating, which means we've been very clear as to where kind of we wanted to spend and what we then, you know, didn't want to use a bit to sort of ensure that sort of longevity. So, and I said at the start, like you see people race and they go and hire like crazy numbers of people. Sometimes it seems like for the sake of doing it, just to have numbers, whereas we've been very specific and going, right, these are the things we need to do to like accelerate by a lot. Like, how do we achieve them in the most sort of economical way? And that's where we've kind of been very calculated, going, okay, we only need to take on X amount of more people. Let's outsource this thing for a fixed cost. Let's do this thing for this, and we'll achieve that. End of. Like, and the rest of it, we keep the same mentality we had when, you know, we didn't have sort of this kind of investment in the bank of book your flights in the sales. Like, make sure if someone's going to an event, like there is genuine value in someone being there. Like, if we're going to spend a bit of marketing dollar, again, like understand what the return is going to be and the upside for us in doing that. Keep that mentality and you know, ensure that we're in a position where now we don't need to worry sort of about something running out, like it's just not going to. And again, I think we're in a, I wouldn't say lucky position, because we worked like bloody hard for the last 3 years, but we're in a really nice position of growth. I think we're at near 30 clients now. You know, they're all a lot alive already, more of those coming live. We have a pipeline of a lot coming in, and we're seeing the revenues now starting, or have been for a while, but increasing quite a bit. And so I think like we have a very clear and positive future.
Yeah. It's already proven itself. Now it's just getting out there and continue doing the work that you're already doing.
But with the same mentality, I think,
yep.
You know, and probably a mistake that some have made in the past is to have changed their approach and mentality just because at a given snapshot, you know, the bank account looks really good.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas, like, we want it to maintain looking good and not just spend it because it's there.
No.
And have it saved for when an opportunity arises that might require some capital. Like, we will have it.
Exactly.
You know? And I think that's absolutely key.
Yeah. And I think, you know, James, you're an ultra marathon runner. Of course, like, I'm a runner as well. And we know that when you start a marathon, you have full energy, right?
Yeah.
And it is, if you're inexperienced, it's easy to start the marathon too fast, right? You feel great, there's a lot of adrenaline there, and you start that race and you run faster than what you usually do, and you just feel great, and you're like, oh my god, this feels fantastic, like,
yeah,
this is, I want to run even faster than I think I should be doing. But then that comes back to bite you later in the race, right? And that's what we're talking about here.
I think that's
when you raise capital and you're like, I can do so many things with this money, But then later on, it comes back to bite you when you maybe are in a little bit of a downturn. And so.
I mean, you know what? I think that's a good example. And perhaps that's that kind of subconsciously plays into my mind a bit when, you know, planning and budgeting and everything.
That, it's a great background to have, I think.
Yeah. Like, you know, touching on some of the ultras, sort of like the one in the desert for 7 days.
Yes. By the way, James ran Marathon des Sables, the hardest foot race in the world. James ran through the Sahara Desert for 7 days.
A while ago. But yeah. But again, with that, you know, the mentality is that you have to sort of slow and steady wins the race. Not that I won it, but I did okay, but I didn't win it. But, you know, to have day one gone out at a sprint pace, like you're just buggered for the other 5 or 6 days. You have nothing left. Right. Your reserves are gone, right? Yeah.
It's the consistency.
It's, and it's that consistency, and it's knowing that you've got to like get up and perform at the same level every day. And I think we have that a little bit kind of in flows that we, and you know, and it's probably ultras, marathons, whatever, are probably more reflective of a B2B company than perhaps some of the B2Cs that can be a bit more of a sprint race.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you can calculate, okay, if we start a company on this, these marketing dollars, there's some pretty good equations that will show, like, we should have this as our GGR, depending on what market they're in, etc.
Yeah.
You know, B2B, like SaaS software company, is a frigging grind. You know, there's a reasonable path to profit that is not overnight, rarely overnight, I guess. There's always exception to rule, but you've got to be in it for that kind of longer term.
Yeah.
And pace yourself in the company based off that.
And I think as well, I mean, there's some great parallels to draw here, to be honest with. So say in your 7 day race, like, you might have days where you feel fantastic, right? And the weather is in your favor, and it's a slight downhill kind of thing, and things are flowing really nicely, no pun intended. And you feel like this day I'm going to increase my pace to improve my time and so on and so forth, but that is short-term thinking, because the next day it could be raining, the next day it could be an uphill, the next day you could be facing challenges, and when that day comes, you want to make sure that you have energy and resources to take you through that day. And it is the consistent pace that will enable you to keep going when you have setbacks as well, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, keeping in line with this process of calling it an ultra or a marathon, I think when you're on the uphills, as in one of these long races, go slow, kind of reflect, you know, re-energize where possible, because then on the downhill, accelerate, as in, you know, when things are going well, do more of that. Like, again, like, it can sometimes be really freaking like black and white, and people overcomplicate it and yard on for ages about, like, oh, this. It's like, no, just, you know, have the benefit of learning from the mistake. We all make them. We all make lots of them, to be fair. You know, learn from it. Be better next time. But also, don't be complacent when you're like, oh, I'm running really fast. Or like, I'm feeling good. Things are going well. Ask yourself why. And then, can we do more of that? Because, like, we need to capitalize on that kind of feel-good thing, on the thing that's working.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, it amazes me sometimes, those that get complacent when they're doing well and not understand why they're doing well. They just, we're just doing well. Like, this has gone up. I don't know why this is happening, but it is, so good for us.
Yeah.
And then, like, they're shocked when it doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, what can we do to get back? So I don't know, because I never understood why we were doing well. We just were.
Yeah.
So, like, we internalize a lot of flows. And when we see kind of clients, for example, you know, doing a lot more, like, volumes going up, accelerating, spending more with us, ultimately, it's like, why are they doing that? Like, where are they drawing value that makes them really happy with us? And, like, you know, and how can we now replicate that in other situations where people are using it but maybe a bit stagnant? Like, how can we improve their kind of use of the tool or their experience to ultimately, for us, obviously, improve on that kind of spend with us, but also for them to feel like ever greater, like, value return.
Yeah. And I suppose if we continue on this marathon analogy, we're not gonna drop it as of yet.
You're not.
I ran a marathon. I did a marathon
did
a couple of days ago.
I'm like
completely bitten by the running bug at the moment. So everything in my head is like running analogies right now.
Yeah, as like I said earlier, I'm in a different place. I've been rewatching, the Michael Jordan Last Dance. So
right.
I'm just thinking R&B,
basketball,
90s R&B scene. That's where my head's at. And even though I'm completely the wrong sort of shape and size to play basketball, and never have, I would love to be a basketball player now, just based off that.
So, gotta eat some like growth pills first, I think, James.
Yeah, I think this is one of those ones where I just have to accept I'm not going to be a basketball player and not compete at kind of Madison Square Garden.
Never give up, my friend. One day they called my call, my friend. Then you got to be ready. You got to have the phone always ready by your side.
Yeah, we want like a really...
The call comes, it comes.
We need a short, like skinny guy from the UK. That's probably way too old now. I'm here.
There we go. But yeah, so my point was, you know, in these long races, your energy levels will fluctuate. And yeah. I can imagine that your motivation will fluctuate as well. That at some part of this race, you might want to just not continue or to take yourself out of this and whatnot. And I think, if I look back on the years of running next, the kind of commitment I have is always like it's always full on, but my energy can fluctuate for sure. You know, that's just the part of the game, I think. And you know, after building flows now for a couple of years, how is your like how do you feel about your own energy that you pull into the company? Is it still the same as it was in the beginning?
Yeah.
Do you start like does it start wavering a little bit, or how do you feel?
I don't think. You know, my commitment to flows has never fluctuated one bit. I think, you know, myself and others that were there at the start, we knew what we wanted to sort of deliver, to execute on.
Yeah.
And our commitment to do that has never wavered. And kudos to the team. Theirs has never wavered either. Like, everyone's been fully supportive from day one, which is, like, it's just been awesome. And that, I mean, it gives me energy as well. Like, if I'm having a bit of a low moment, you can see others around you being like, come on, yeah, this is solid. Like, we all pull each other together. And there's certainly been more highs than there have been the kind of inevitable lows, I think, of startup life. But energy has been just a consistent on it.
Yep.
Like, and will continue to be. Honestly, yeah, I do love it. I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't. I mean, because, frick, the stress levels at times are way too much if you didn't ultimately sort of love and believe what you're doing.
For sure.
Hell no, would you continue doing that? So,
I think that there's like a distinction there between motivation. Like, motivation can come and go. That's kind of a bit of a definition. I suppose 1 week you have it, 1 week you don't, and that's how it is with motivation essentially. But drive is more like a baseline, I think.
Yeah.
So like, rather than asking if like. Are you motivated to continue? It's more like, yeah, but you know, maybe 1 week I feel motivated, 1 week I don't. It's like, but what's the drive to continue to push through all this like difficulty and gritty moments of building something?
Always. And I think I'm a relatively competitive person as well. And I think that kind of,
that's
side driver, is like really kind of a driver as well.
So yeah,
like,
because you have that competitive drive.
Make it, you know, we've started this. When this is going to happen.
We're going to finish it, yeah.
And we're going to finish it like, in first,
yeah.
Like, you know, I know everyone says, but I say that like we are all committed to this being. It is, I think, one of the best sort of tool out there. Obviously, I say that, but you know, we're committed to making sure everyone else sees that and understands that. And yeah, very driven with this.
Yeah, and it's an interesting phenomenon that you know in how you have kind of built and conducted yourself in your life. That's like. Every time you have this little victory, like you go on a marathon that is really difficult or whatever else it could be that is a challenge to you, could be that you study something that you want to study for a master. You know, it takes a long, long time to get there, or many other challenges that you set out in life. I think every time you complete one of these like difficult, gritty challenges, you perceive yourself more as a winner, let's say. And if you get to a point where you give up, essentially, and like when you are in one of these races or so on, like you cannot take a step down as the perception of who you are and so on. And I think building these wins to yourself and like building up that confidence that you can go through really difficult things, because that I don't think people are born with that necessarily. That comes with life and the challenges that you are put through. And if you're able to persevere and kind of build, you want to always take challenges that are not too easy, because then they are not fun. It's just it's not a challenge. And also they shouldn't be too hard, because then they are it's impossible to achieve them. But there is a Goldilocks zone there where a challenge feels really difficult. You don't know if you're gonna make it, but then you end up doing it with your like 95% or something like that. And building that confidence over time builds you into this type of person that will finish what you start, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll always finish what you start. I think a lot of it, and maybe as you say, it's built over time and then kind of intrinsically in you, because I think so much is subconscious. You kind of, it's weird. I dwell and sort of think a lot more about, you know, the losses, if you want to call them that, or the downs, than I do on the wins. In a sense that, you know, whether it's, you know, the win of a client or securing investment or, you know, whatever the big kind of piece is, I don't sort of want to sit and celebrate, because I guess ultimately it's not like job done, right? It's not like, oh, you know, got the raise, tools down, everyone, we're out.
Yeah,
that's exactly. Oh, cool. If anything, it's like, right, you know, we've just gone from kind of this league into this league now, and we now need to perform. And honestly, like off the back, you know, day two post raise is like, we need to be in training game, because we're now needing to compete at a far higher level. Like there's new expectation and kind of, we just got to push bloody hard. Like,
yeah,
it's just never job done. And I don't,
exactly.
Which is why I don't like to dwell, you know, too much on, like, you, there's an element, obviously you have to celebrate the wins. But for me, it's kind of, at least in our stage as a company, there, the wins are just getting us to the next like level, as I said, to the next league. If you take it like, you know, football, soccer for the US audience, but you know, you're like in championship and then your wins just getting into the Premier League. But ultimately,
until you're
winning the Premier League, like you're not won. You know, you're better than you were before, but you're not the best.
Yeah.
So I still like, we still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
We've come a long way and we're doing really well. But you know, there's no taking your foot off. We've got to push more now.
Yeah. And if we, to start to kind of like going full circle here and so on, where do you see the company in 3 years' time from now?
It's always a like hard question to answer.
Yeah.
At its base, doing what we do now, just on a far bigger scale. In terms of, client numbers, for one, will be like massively sort of accentuated from where we are today. I think, and even with the clients we have today, we'll be doing a lot more with us. The sort of tool itself will continue to develop. I'm excited to see like more of the routes we go down, further utilizing the sort of language models. I think we're going to have a really big product suite as well. So I said sort of earlier, these smaller like add-on products we're going to start sort of building out for clients that they can take to complement what they already have with the engine if they want them. You know, you have these nice kind of off-the-shelf add-ons. I see us in one, maybe two other markets, but again, this is like so hypothetical in terms of what I believe could be us in 3 years at this very point sat here, but who knows the reality of that. I'm excited at the minute to sort of act on our plans over the next, you know, 6 months to 9 months. And there's just so many exciting things that will happen for us over this year. And a lot we're gonna deliver on, which I think is like, you know, ultimately sort of the big focus point for us at this time.
Amazing. And one of the goals is that you committed yourself to run an ultra marathon together with me in 1 year's time as well. So that's also part of the goal.
That's part of it, yeah, right?
Gotta take some time off for that as well. Gran Canaria, February 2025. You and me, James.
Okay, we're in.
120K. You're committed now.
You're committing to that. One thing I always wanted to do. So when I finished the MGS, it's always like, okay, cool, you've done it. But what's next? What could be a challenge that, like, all these things have to be a proper challenge, right? It's like,
yeah.
I've never been a distance runner, so do the hardest one. So next one's like, I've never rode before, like, you know, in a row, but kind of going back and forth.
All right.
And there's a race called, I think it's like the Talisker challenge, but basically it's rowing across the Atlantic.
Oh, wow.
So,
oh, my God. Bring the laptop up, my friend.
Portugal down, down into sort of across to America. And
Jesus Christ.
So for Christmas, I think, because it's like the best trade wins and stuff. But it's a big, it's a big race. It's a reasonably famous one. And you do it like, some people do single, which I wouldn't. I'd go mad, I think, and lose my mind that long at sea. But you can do it up to a four. I think maybe there's more, but I thought a foursome would be really cool. You get in a boat. I think you finish at Santiago, I want to say. So you imagine you spend kind of 40 days rowing across the Atlantic.
Grab a beer in Antigua and then row back.
Wouldn't that be cool?
And then row back.
Yeah. No rowing back. It's done. You would never want to see that boat again. I had a friend that did it while ago. Like, amazing kind of charity effort.
Wow.
And I was always very sort of envious of that experience, I think. Yeah. I'm not sure when I would ever have the time to do it, but because it is, I mean, A, the commitment to just train, and then it's 40 days out of your life over Christmas.
I like that. But, I like that, like, you know, when you think about a challenge to do for yourself, that there are levels in your like grandiosity of thinking. That you know, some person might say, you know, I want to do a half marathon or something like this, and that's like the big challenge. And then other people are like, yeah, I want to row across the Atlantic.
I think one reason, because a lot of this stuff, you need some help. Like, you need maybe you'll be raising money for charity or something like that. Okay, and no one's going to do it if they know you can. You know, like you know, you ran your marathon the other day. I had no doubt you could run a marathon. So if you were like, hey, support, okay, if it was a good charity, probably throw a couple of quid. But it's not like, I'm doing this because maybe he can't. Like, I think if you kind of turn around and said, you know, I'm running 10 times around Malta, it's like, shit, like, can someone do that? That sounds really hard. Like, I want to support you on this because I know the effort that goes into it. I think, you know, to say that I was going to do an ultra, like, you know, I have done them before.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I don't think, you know.
Oh, exactly. You're familiar with that.
It's got to be an element. You might die on these things, you know. So
yeah.
I think someone going, you're in the Atlantic, you never rowed. I'm obviously not a rower build. So I think, like, that is a challenge that, you know, you'd have the support as well to kind of, to help push on and help drive you.
Yeah.
Like, if you know you can do something, you're not really driven to, like, to do it, or will I go to a training session if I know I can still do it?
Yeah, I know you're gonna do it.
I mean, I hate the open sea like that. I'd be absolutely crapping it. I'd be in every training session and some.
Exactly.
To ensure that anything I can control, I could, and I'd do okay.
It's because of the fear that drives you to get to that point.
More than anything.
Yeah.
And it's the same with desert, right? Like, running that, it's kind of, obviously, having never run over a desert. You know, again, fear driving the training a lot in that one, and making sure, you know, knew how to take my salt tablets and all of that to stop dehydration and heart attacks and whatever else. Right.
when do you think the rowing is going to happen?
I don't know. I mentioned it a long time ago to my wife, Emma. And
what was her reaction to that?
She didn't see it in the same way I did. But I think the kind of compromise was the kids would need to be old enough to understand, like, what I was doing and kind of that's why I was doing it. And also I'd be able to afford to take them all there for like a week's holiday.
Okay.
So there's a lot of things I can't do at the minute in that. In fact, there's really nothing I can do right now to commit to it. But long term, It is a goal.
Your wife is very smart by including that clause of when the kids are old enough to understand why you're doing it, because maybe they'll never understand.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a good get out chat.
Very smart. She got you there. Yeah.
I think also because it's like over Christmas, so it's kind of, you know,
yeah.
Why is Dad not here at Christmas? This is like odd.
Yeah.
Secretly, it's Father Christmas.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, James. Now it's out there, so now the audience is going to expect more updates on the rowing next.
And if anyone out there wants to commit with me, then you know, there's four of us in this boat, and
go with the flow, my friend.
One of us is loosely committing at some point to do it.
So, go with the flow. Just go with the flow.
Go with the flow. Yeah.
All right, my friend. It's been fantastic. Like
always, been awesome.
You've been you're one of the OGs of the podcast, and here we are again. One of the guests who have been here most out of anyone. Always a pleasure, my friend. It was a great training session earlier today as well. Always looking forward to catch up with you, my friend.
No, I've loved it. Really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me. Amazing studio.
Yeah,
it's really cool. It was worth flying out to Malta to be in a studio.
Good.
Cheers for that.
All right. Cheers. Awesome, man.
Thank you.